And good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where you are on this constantly rotating globe. Welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn, where on this weekend, on The Other Side of Midnight, we are going to present evidence which inevitably, at some point, is going to change your life forever. Now, we've broken this down into two parts because it turns out that David and I have been pursuing kind of the same objective, but from two very different scientific perspectives. Before we get into all this, let me give you some context. We are having what appears to be, at least from my vivid memories, a kind of a flashback to the late 1960s, the same time period when I got a call one day and they said, I'm Frank Manitzis, I'm speaking for Walter Cronkite. We'd like to help us go to the moon. And I said, what? Anyway, it was a time of intense social unrest and protest visible on every TV screen. And as a backdrop, there was this celestial component, which was in December of 1968, in the modern era, men from Earth visited the moon for the first time in a very, 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 very long time. And the juxtaposition of this incredible political unrest going on, rising. I know it seems like it's everywhere. Actually, it's only on about a dozen campuses out of over 6,000 universities and colleges in the United States. So remember the amplification factor of television. What was it Roddenberry kept saying to me? Dick, if it's real, it will be on television. So Columbia and UCLA are on television, and Dartmouth and forget all the ones that are not because they're the overwhelming predominant number. But we get this distorted filter through the lens of television. Well, this is an echo. Remember, history is not supposed to repeat, but it sure as damn well is supposed to rhyme. Well, it's rhyming. And if I could drag Rick Levine over on the show for the next week or two, it's rhyming according to a recurring physics pattern of the hyperdimensional model against which this is all playing out. So why do I have number one as the anti-war protest ruffles another university, this time Michigan? Because it's part and parcel of some astonishing new data on the Israeli-Iran war. Because that's what this really is. The Hamas is merely a surrogate. That's currently going on in the Middle East and which, in the opinion of some, including this observer, is bringing us closer to nuclear war than we have been since the good old duck and cover days of my childhood in school. And that is not a good thing. So tonight and tomorrow night, we're going to present an alternative future, an alternative model of reality, where the human race realizes it's got much bigger potential problems and opportunities against which this current cycle is just endlessly repeating an almost biblical compunction in the Middle East. An eye for an eye times 10 times 1,000 times 20,000 times. I mean, how many innocent people have killed in this insanity? And there's no end in sight because the players are determined to act out Armageddon. I mean, that's really kind of what this is. So what force is big enough to counteract Armageddon? The real history in images, in numbers, in story of the human species, which has got to stop doing this stuff it's doing Otherwise, it will come, as you will see, to a very bad end. My guest tonight, as we kind of go through all this, is David Sirita. David is very hard to encapsulate in less than an hour of reciting all the things he has done. He is a generalist. He is a technologist. He works with hyperdimensional physics and technology. He was married to Crystal until she died a very untimely death a couple, 3 years ago. And actually, it's probably less, you know, it was very sad, and it still is sad. But there is this extraordinary backdrop, because like my continuing communication with Robin, and that is evolving in a very, very productive direction. When I can't really say much more, but we may actually be on the verge of some kind of serious breakthrough here. Well, David has had the same kind of experiencing communication from Crystal Dover, and it's of a very different but complementary nature to the information that Robin has managed to send me in really some extraordinary ways. Anyway, so my guest tonight is David Sirita, my friend, my colleague. David, welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. We're going to be talking about the backdrop, the evidence, the scientifically provable motif of a designer solar system, and what that means in terms of where do we go from here. So, David, are you there?
Well, there you are. Can you hear me? You hear me all right?
Yeah, it sounded like you crashed into a whole bunch of cymbals, or you dropped a million forks.
Well, we may be. I'm hearing some sound skipping in and out here. Hopefully, we're.
No, you're now fine. So, you had something really interesting that you observed, apparently, about the recent eclipse. The eclipse is going to feature in a major way tomorrow night, and actually probably a week from tomorrow night, because we found, triggered by the eclipse itself, a whole bunch of new data, which, unless we're all just nuts, absolutely irrevocably proves this solar system did not evolve naturally, but somebody had a very deep technological, super advanced, beyond relief civilization hand in shaping it for certain strategic objectives. The first of which, I think, is us. This is about us. It's about teaching us something. Overwhelmingly, I'll shut up and you can begin. What did you think of the eclipse?
Well, I mean, it's enormous in its implications. It's almost like when I reveal. I wish I could show the graphic. I'm waiting for Keith to put these graphics up.
You're a little bit hot on your mic. You can turn down.
Okay, I'll come back a bit here. Is that better?
Yeah. Let me turn it here. Go ahead.
So we had I have a graphic of what I call the three great eclipses that form the Aleph, and it's August 21st, 2017 was the first total eclipse crossed from Upper Oregon and Washington State heading east into the Carolinas.
Yeah, it was August. And, it was August 21. It could cross from one sea to
that,
the other.
That date is a mind-blowing date, because there's a whole research paper done on this, that is the true date of Jesus' birthday, which is what the Urantia book of all.
Wait. How do we go from the eclipse to Jesus?
You're going to see this.
You lost me. Connect me.
Okay, just watch. There's three eclipses.
Okay. All right, hang on. We should say that the crucifixion of Jesus Christ was marked by an eclipse, but it was the moon.
It was
the moon, not the sun.
Well, there was no eclipse that date, and it of the moon and the sun. And I'm going to demonstrate this really.
Wait, you mean the canonical date crucifixion of Jesus?
Yes.
Well, did we expect there would be? You have to go find the right eclipse, because those dates were very shifty.
From the research I've done on multiple dates, there was no lunar solar eclipse on that date anywhere near it. And so look at the three dates for a second of the three eclipses. So August 21st, which I'm gonna demonstrate, is one heck of a date. It's also my birthday. So the second eclipse, which was last year, which was an annual eclipse, was October 14th. And that was 2023. Now, October 13th was Fatima, Miracle of the Sun, in 1917.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to demonstrate how actually our calendar is slightly out right now, because what we did when we switched from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar, which was it was Thursday, the 4th of October, 1582, immediately became Friday, the 15th of October, 1582, because, not that there's actually no difference between the Julian calendar and the Gregorian calendar, which we started on the 4th of October, 1582, which immediately becomes the 15th of October. And they're both the same, that they both absorb a leap year every 4 years to count for 0.25 days per year. But the actual sidereal time for Earth is 365.25636304. Now, we don't absorb 00636304. So about every 158 years, we are off another day.
Hmm.
And there's no correction for that. So
what happened? Why not?
There's still no correction.
Why? Why?
Because we're not correcting it, because it's 158 years before you have a full day to correct. That's why we're not doing it. Let's go back to those two eclipses again. So let's go back to the...
What, are you telling me historically there have been no corrections other than the leap year?
Just the only correction...
Since the Gregorian calendar was instituted, right?
It's the same.
There is no difference between Julian and Gregorian. They both absorb the leap year, the 0.25, 365.25. But what happened in Gregorian is using a solar alignment, like if you had a Stonehenge or you were using, you know, a solar aligned passage, you would know when you're off 13 days, right? So we went off during the period. This is really interesting, because why didn't we go off before the Gregorian calendar notices in the year 1582, it's because we started keeping time with clocks, and we didn't use the sun in its perfect alignments anymore. We started using clocks, and clocks, believe it or not, even atomic clocks, which we use today, and the U.S. Naval Observatory, which keeps our time, I'm going to go really deeply into time here, we are basically, because of the sidereal timekeeping accurate to 365.25636304, we only absorb the 0.25 every 4 years, right? We had a leap year this past
year. I'm now really concerned that since 1582, if this longer time frame is not accounted for, it means every 158 years you're missing a day. So the calendar is not in sync with how it was adjusted in 1582 at all. Can't be.
Well, guess what?
So if you go, because this is going to be one of my later items, but I'll go into it in much deeper. On December 12, 1531, remember, that's just before the correction, the winter solstice was on December 12th.
Hmm.
Right?
Now it's the 22nd. Now, the winter solstice is a fixed date, but the winter aphelion, if you look at the calendar, sometimes it's the 23rd of December, and sometimes it's January the 3rd, and sometimes, so you have two winter markers. You have the solstice, and then you have
we should, for folks that are not doing astronomy graphics in their head, you probably should.
I know.
You should describe each one.
Okay, so I should really show these in a graphic. And again, I'm waiting for Keith to put up my items, but I just want to mark it so that people understand we don't keep time as perfectly as you think. In fact, every single year, there is a slight loss or gain of as much as 20 minutes and as little as 3 minutes. Every year we're that much off, according to the U.S. Naval Observatory. And they don't know why. There is a gravitational unresolved anomalies on the inner planets in the solar system. They basically fudged off and said it must be the sun is doing something, because we don't know why we're off every year just a little bit. But we're also off every hundred.
When you say off, you mean if you were to take some arbitrary point in the Earth's orbit as a start point and look at a star on the night side of the Earth away from the sun, and then mark time before that sight line would repeat, which was a year later, give or take, you're saying that that time interval can vary from as little as 3 minutes to as much as 20 minutes, and no one professionally knows why?
The Earth's
orbit is physically changing that much, and they don't know why? Well, it's obviously the hyperdimensional part of their stupid equation.
I know. We're going to get into that tonight.
Just wanted to make that point, you know. This reminds me of epicycles, arbitrarily defined epicycles. So continue, please.
So when you mark the beginning of your year, this is really interesting. So you go to the Roman Catholic Church will celebrate Christmas, which is not Jesus' birthday. It is an old, ancient celebration of the new sun, and they'll celebrate it on December 25th. And then the Orthodox will celebrate either on the 6th or the 7th of January. And you know what's interesting about that is the January 1st is exactly in the middle of both of those dates. It's right in the middle exactly of between December 25th and January the 7th.
So it's like an arbitrary average.
It's exactly an arbitrary average. And it's not known. It's really interesting because when I do my math and counting the orbits of my formula that my wife gave me from the other side, and I can see the orbits of all the known planets, but I can see 9 more hyperdimensional planets, one of which in the inner solar system lines up with everything. So watch what happens. Okay, so let's go. And I'll show this in the graphics when Keith gets this up. So let's go.
Well, he's got 1A, he's got 1B, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, good.
5.
Let's look at what he's got.
6.
Okay.
No, he's moving down slowly.
Oh, he's doing good. He's hitting them. Okay, let's go to 1A.
Got it.
And B. Okay, so look at this. So this is mind-blowing what I tend to show people here. If something just told me, I would call it an intuition, something told me, add up all the angles of all the planets in the solar system, and I'm including Pluto, and then I'm going to add their tilt angles. Remember, our tilt angle, Earth, 23.5 degrees, gives us precession, okay? So, which is a huge, very, very long cycle. It's like drawing a circle in throughout the cosmos and coming back to that.
So the round numbers is 26,000 years.
Yeah, yeah, about 26,000 years. So now I'm going to add all these angles up. Neptune is 28.5.
Well, this is just the tilt of the rotational axis of the planet to its orbit around the sun.
Right. This is its axial tilt. All of them have it.
Yep.
So Uranus, as the Greeks pronounced it, 98 degrees, which is very steep. Saturn, 26.7. Jupiter, 3 degrees. I have to add Ceres for my formula to work. Tilted at 4 degrees, which is, we call it a dwarf planet, but it's actually quite sizable.
Well, 600 miles across.
No, I think it's about, Ceres is, I think it's almost, let me just.
600 miles across.
Is that the radius? Ceres?
That's the diameter. I can get it in
it. Yeah. It's about 600 miles across, so it's 1,800 miles.
See, I would have had a free dinner, but I'm a nice guy, so.
Okay, Mars, 25 degrees. Earth, 23.5. Venus is only tilted at 3 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And Mercury is 2 degrees. Now, notice the spin direction. Venus spins opposite to all the other planets in the solar system. And Uranus is, even though it's tilted at 98 degrees, it's kind of like a spinning ball whose axis of spin, even though it's spinning counter like Venus does, it's if you were in a stream of water, you wouldn't be fighting the current because you're tilted away from the current. Whereas Venus is in the current. It's very interesting why Venus is like that. Okay, watch what happens. Go to item 1B.
Okay.
Stunning. Item 1B is stunning. So I'm going to add them all up. Pluto to Mercury is 333.7. And as soon as I saw that number, I went, oh, my God. Because all I have to do is add the slope angle of the Great Pyramid's ascending passage using Peter Lemazuri's precision of 26.3 degrees. And I get a total of 360 degrees. So to my utter astonishment, the tilt angle of the Great Pyramid's ascending passage is reminiscent of the missing planet for the last piece of the puzzle to the designer of all the planets adding their tilt angles up together would equal a 360-degree circle. It's phenomenal. So what does that mean? And think about it. If all the planets are tilted at these various angles and they all add up to, with our hypothetical hyperdimensional missing planet of 360 degrees, what are they aligning to? What is this perfect circle that they're in alignment with in this togetherness? And how does the tilt angle of the Great Pyramid fit in so perfectly in my puzzle there? So I mean perfectly. So that means that if each one of these planets in our solar system, their tilt angle is representative of the planet itself, and the angle...
Wait, what do you mean representative of the planet?
Well, each planet has its proprietary tilting, and therefore the missing angle of 26.3 degrees, and you're going to see this because it's in the eclipse. 26.3 degrees is in the eclipse because we're going to come back to the eclipse.
Okay.
Is symbolic of a hidden planet whose tilt angle is 26.3 degrees that we don't know about, which, according to my formula, I know exactly where it is. I know exactly where this planet is. So now let's go to my item 4, the third picture, which is the Great Aleph. Now, my three eclipses, I'm looking at it right now. So August 21st, arguably Jesus' real birthday, and I've seen a very good research paper that puts, using scripture and mathematics, Jesus' birthday in the old calendar, which would be Julian, because under the Romans, the calendar was Julian, that Jesus would have been born August 8th, which with the correction in the 16th century would put him at August 21st today. Okay, so let's just put that date there. You don't have, it's not about believing or not believing. Just put that date in your head. The second eclipse is the anniversary of the miracle of the sun at Fatima, which, again, I will resolve perfectly with this formula, is October 14th, because we're one day off. Remember, it was the 13th of October, 1970. An April 8th eclipse that we just had was Easter in 2012. It was the date for Easter in 1917. And if you put, which I've done, I actually have graphics of this, I put these dates onto a lunar calendar and juxtaposed it with our modern calendar, and you always keep coming back in the lunar calendar to your original date. So your original date in the solar calendar will return in a lunar calendar about every 12 years. Sometimes it's off by one date. So again, notice the angle. I measured the angle of the three eclipse triangle. It's 26.3 degrees.
Where the two eclipses cross the Oregon coast.
Right. Where the two eclipses cross the Oregon coast, and therefore, once again, symbolic of the missing angle in the total of all the angles of the planets to equal a 360-degree circle. So why is that? So just hold that thought, because now when we come to Fatima, so you're going to have to understand a little bit about France.
Hang on. What we probably need to do is to describe Fatima, and we're within a couple of minutes of the bottom of the hour, so we'll do that when we come back from the break, because I don't want to leave anybody behind. And I'm seeing correspondences that are raising really found designer type questions in my mind.
Good. So Fatima, I will prove, is an actual hyperdimensional planet, an antimatter or hyperdimensional planet or hyperdimensional portal. I don't know that it's a planet. And I know exactly where its orbit is. And like Venus, which produces transits in double pairs every 100 or so years, you're lucky to see a Venus transit in your lifetime, people, just even one of them. And I actually got to witness one. So what the eyewitnesses saw,
and I got to measure both of them hyperdimensionally. Boy, are transits important.
So transits are very important to understand what I'm going to show you about Fatima. It's Fatima. Really quick as a teaser before the top of the hour, at the bottom of the hour, there are two Fatimas. There was one October 13th, 1917. Taylor, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour.
Mike Fatima.
Two. Wow. My guest this morning is David Sarita, who, as you know, is really big on numbers. They're a graphic, so you can go and see the pictures, and that will make the numbers very clear. Again, we're approaching this, he and I, from two very different perspectives. He's looking at a buried code in human culture. Actually more than one, which recursively, which is what codes need to do if they're going to communicate a message through the noise, which recursively tells us or tells him, which matches missing pieces of an ancient solar system. My data, which we'll demonstrate tomorrow night, is a tad more empirical. I've got pictures. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, the 4th of May of 2024. I can't believe it's May already. The crocuses are croaking. Actually, that's not what they're doing, but nothing else rhymed. Hey, tonight we've got David Cerita with us, who, of course, is a mathematical genius compared to all the rest of us. And don't feel bad if you need me to have him repeat a couple things, because I'm struggling to follow just as much as you guys. So, David, let's pick up where we left off.
Okay, so we're talking about Fathom. And what witnesses saw, if you really, really read the multiple reports like I have, it looks like an annular eclipse. And an annular eclipse was the October 14th eclipse last year in 2023.
And this year.
Yeah, but wait. How could there be an eclipse around Fathom when there were no eclipse around
Fathom? Well, we're going to explain that. It's a hyperdimensional planet whose orbit is 139 to 144 days around the sun between Venus and Mercury. So watch what happens. In basically, the witnesses at Fathom, they describe colors and rings.
Well, you need to back up and talk about the whole story. What was Fathom? Who showed up? Who were the girls? What does see? Yeah, the whole thing. Yeah. This is the linchpin of your model. You know, we shouldn't give it short shrift.
Yeah, let's don't do a short trip on this, because this is massive, because it's going to tie into the 26.3 degrees, and it's going to tie into the model that I presented previously on your show that my wife gave me, showing where the 9 hyperdimensional planets are in our solar system, their orbital periods around the sun, and the known planets in our solar system and their orbital periods. So what happens at Fathom is actually, it's 1917, and in May the 13th, actually, so here we are at May 4th. On the 13th of May, the Mother Mary appears to 3 village children in this town region of what we call Fathom, Portugal today. And she tells that she gets to them on the 13th of every month, and she's getting them ready for this huge event that will be 5 months later on the 13th of October. But the visions start.
Oh, so it had a long runway.
It had a long runway. And May 13th is actually one orbit of planet 139. And I'll have to show you how I calculated an orbit, because what I was demonstrating earlier is we actually have 2 start dates for the beginning of a solar year. January 1st is right in the middle of those 2 dates, which is 3 days after winter solstice is December 25th, which was an ancient, on the old calendar, was the celebration of the new sun in the Roman system.
Well, wasn't it Saturnalia?
And that's another festival. Saturnalia is another festival. So then,
which is still celebrated in Northern Britain.
Yeah, I actually read about that. I know about that. So then January 7th and 6th, both of those dates are the dates for different Orthodox churches. And remember, the Orthodox Church is the oldest church. The Roman Church didn't even exist yet at the time of Christ, and didn't even exist yet when James, the brother of Jesus, headed the first church. There was no Roman church. So what we have are 2 dates. And if you look, if you go back to, and this is quite miraculous, if you go back to when the changeover occurred, on the 4th of October, 1582, instantly became the October 15th in 1582 because we had to absorb 13 days, right? And again, January 1st is in the middle of a 13-day span between December 25th and January 7th.
Hmm.
So remember, the I don't want to say this because I don't want to go into a distraction, but the incursion at the U.S. Capitol was...
I was just thinking of January 6th and why the founders, you know, and the Congresses and all that ultimately put that date for the confirmation, the certification, on that date. They could have picked any date.
The date of the big, you know, whatever you want to call it.
See, there is a major celestial portent to the creation of this nation, which is about to be, according to my research, fulfilled.
And you'll see another date that we'll be coming into, because remember, Fatima was on the new calendar. We were on Gregorian calendar in 1917. And so Fatima happens October 13th, 1917, and the White House chief cornerstone is laid October 13th, but about 225 years before Fatima. Can you believe that?
Hmm.
So you'll have to
well, you know why I can? Because I'm looking at this whole Trump thing, and we're going to, you know, have a few little data points tomorrow night that nobody, I guarantee you, has thought of. But it's all about kingship. It's all about the ancient Egyptian calendar, which, of course, the president is Horus. He is a sun king. And one of the guys who currently wants the job wants him to be sun king again. What do you want?
I think you're bringing up a really important point. You know, it's really interesting because if you start with December 25th, which is not Jesus' birthday, in the original book of Matthew, which the Church of James, which is the first Christian church, only used the original book of Matthew. There was no other gospel.
Well, you've got those damn shepherds in the fields, and they would not be in the fields in December, period.
Right. Exactly. He was born August 8th on the old calendar, which would be the 21st on our calendar. So it actually... It's really interesting, though, because Hippolytus, who was a Roman historian, but also a member of the early forming church. I don't want to say there's a Catholic church in the third century yet, because it's not really correctly a church yet. But he uses the date December 25th in the 42nd year of Augustus, 5,500 years after Adam, as the date that the earliest Christians, no, I don't want to say the earliest Christians because we're in the third century now, that the Romans were establishing to be the birth date of Jesus. But again, if you take December 25th and you do your correction in Julian to Gregorian, remember, they're both the same. They both absorb a quarter of a day, which is why you have a leap year. Why did it go off 13 days? Because the rest of the decimal didn't get corrected because we started using clocks instead of the sun. Now, had we been using the sun precisely, I mean, right down to the nth of a degree, because how much of a degree is a single day on a sun clock, right? So we went off, and guess what happens on the exact day of the correction, on the 4th of October, 1582, becomes October, October 4th, 1582 becomes Friday, October 15th. Well, that happens to be the date that St. Teresa of Avila dies. She dies exactly then. Of course, they couldn't have planned that, but how the heck did she manage to do that? And St. Francis, he lines up with that perfectly as well. So what happens in mid-October, and when you go from the very first apparition of the Mother Mary to the three children, May the 13th,
Now we're back in 1917.
Yeah, we're back in 1917 to the miracle of the sun at Fatima, because there's two Fatimas. and you're not going to believe what the second Fatima tells us. It's mind-blowing what it tells us. But what happens is, if you count, you're 139 days into the year, May the 13th. Now, that's her first day of appearance. And on my graphic, I think Keith has it up on your site. Let me just make sure if he does. It's right there. It's item two. So item two, if you click on it, I just want to recap this because we've done this before. My wife calls out my name audibly, shaking me out of my bed. It's 591 days after she died. 591 days divided by the golden ratio, 1.618063987, is the exact sidereal time for Earth. It's exact. Divided by the golden ratio again is Venus. Divided by the golden ratio again is this mysterious hyperdimensional planet 139. And divided by the golden ratio again is Mercury. So let's just stop there because this formula keeps going. Planet 139 is exactly one orbit into the year. I think I have to start at December 25th for that calculation to be perfect. And so why does Mary come in on exactly one orbit of 139? Why does she do that? You could say, and why is the miracle of the sun at Fatima two orbits of 139? So 139.51 times two will give me approximately like 98.9% the miracle of the sun at Fatima, October 13th. So why such perfection in harmony with the ratio and orbit of a planet that, according to us and our telescopes, isn't there
anymore?
Well, any more in a visible sense, any more than planet Vulcan, which astronomers saw and didn't see, and then they saw it and they didn't see it. They knew it wasn't sunspots. They knew they were looking at a planet.
David, this is bizarre.
I know.
This is exactly the same phenomenon I'm going to talk about and show in the outer solar system tomorrow night. Things
and
that keep...
This formula goes to the outer solar system, too.
They should appear and disappear like they shouldn't.
Remember how electrons in the orbit around the nucleus of an atom, the proton or the neutron, will suddenly disappear and reappear. So I would expect a planet to do such a thing, but very infrequently. Okay, so let's go into the second Fatima. Okay, so watch this. So when the miracle of the sun happens on October 13th, 1917, they're seeing spinning colors, everything that kind of is reminiscent of an annular eclipse where you have the ring of fire in the outer rim. However, on that date, October 13th, 1917, there was no solar on calendar. So what obscured the sun on that exact date in that time? We know in my hyperdimensional model that there's a planet that orbits about 139 and a half days. And we're counting Earth time, by the way. So when I say days, that's everything is at Earth time. So when we count the orbits of the planets in the inner solar system and outer solar system, it's always in Earth days. That's our timekeeping.
Okay.
Just to be clear. So what happens is in the year 1950, Pope Pius the 12th sees Fatima again, and he sees it again in October. It's actually the end of October on that year. So it's in alignment with my planet 139 again because I'm in October. And guess what? They're 33 years apart. Now, to understand what...
No, wait, back up. What did Pope... Would you say it was Francis?
No, Pope Pius the 12th.
Pius the 12th, okay.
This is 1950. You were alive then, right?
I was 5 years old.
You were 5 years old. He sees Fatima again. He records it.
What do you mean he sees Fatima again?
He sees the same thing. He sees an annular type eclipse around.
So, you need to talk. You know, Fatima to me is the girls and Mary and all that.
I know, but it's the miracle of the sun part that he.
So he sees a celestial apparition. Do we know the details?
Yes, we have lots of details. He recorded it very well, and his descriptions are remarkable in that they resemble the Fatima Miracle of the Sun. But what interests me is they're 33 years apart. So guess what is 33 years apart? The star Bethlehem appeared at the moment of Jesus' birth. He died at the age of 33 when there was 3 hours of darkness on the cross, another eclipse, which again did not line up with a lunar solar eclipse. 33 years apart. Now, guess what does that? They're called double transits. Venus will do something very similar. So what you do, I don't have this as an item, so you look up Venus transit. And a Venus transit always comes in pairs, always. In fact,
and the pairs are roughly 120 years apart.
No, the pairs are not 120 years apart.
That's what I just said.
No, the pairs are not 120 years apart in Venus transits. Venus transit. So we had a Venus transit on the 8th of June, 2004.
Right. And then we had one in 2008, and then it was 120 years since we had the
2012. We had one in 2012.
Yeah.
And then it'll be over 100 years before the pair comes back again.
I think it'll 120 years.
Yeah, right. It'll be over 100 years. So the next one will be the 10th to the 11th of December, 2117. And then there'll be another one on the 8th of December, 2125. So the distance between the pairs is over 100 years. Mm-hmm. So notice that Jesus, we have star Bethlehem, which I believe was in nighttime. Appearance of our hyperdimensional planet 139, and it, he dies on the cross 33 years later, and it produces an eclipse at the time of the cross, 3 hours of darkness, which would be a very long eclipse, by the way. That just doesn't make sense to maybe it was shadowy and darker and then shadowy over the three-hour period. So again, that is reminiscent. Notice the Pope, but this is 1917, and then 1950, we've got two Fatimas 33 years apart. So, and it wasn't Venus, because I've checked the transits of Venus. They go all the way back.
Yeah, and of course, 33 is part of the hyperdimensional model.
So that would mean we have physical recorded documenting of a bright star at night, which could not possibly have been a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn, because I witnessed that with my telescope a few winters ago, and that's not really as bright as people thought it was going to be, to explain the brightness of the star Bethlehem. And 33 years later, he dies on the cross, and you have a daytime.
So are you talking about some kind of physics where the invisible becomes visible from our perspective at certain key times?
Talking about something like that.
That's the same thing I found, except it's not in the inner solar system. It's in the outer solar system. It's like all this data is showing us we live in a designer solar system. And guess what? Somebody left the power on, because it's still at some level appears to be functioning.
See, I can't wait to look on my big chart what you're seeing in the outer solar system, because look, in the universe of the atom and smaller, where we study quantum mechanics, if an electron orbiting the neutron and proton, which is where all your quarks are, that's where most of the mass of the atom is, just like most of the mass in the solar system is in the sun. And the planets, constituent planets, are like subatomic particles. And an electron, by the way, is one of the, it is pretty much among the lightest of all particles. I mean, most subatomic particles, I've studied all of them, are pretty heavy. So watch this. So when we look at, okay, remember, so May 13th, when the Mother Mary appeared to the children to start preparation for the miracle of the sun, is equal to one orbit of 139. And the miracle of the sun itself is equal to 2. So 139 times 2 is, and that's a full 139 times 2 is 278. Guess how many times the word heaven appears in the New Testament? In the original Greek, which it was written in, 278 times. So the word heaven in Greek is actually in the original scripture, Uranos, which is the name we gave to the planet Uranus.
Yep.
In English. There was no Uranus and Neptune at the time of Dante. I'm going to bring up Dante now because Dante is a poet who records his spiritual out-of-body visions, if for lack of a better word, for his time period. He had real visions, and he described two more spheres that he lands on beyond Saturn, which he called the eighth and the ninth. Later, way after Dante's time period, we gave those eighth and ninth positions the name Uranus and Neptune. And guess what Dante experiences at the ninth level of the solar system in his visions? He meets Christ in this blinding light, and Christ turns into what appears to be like an interdimensional, hyperdimensional super sun. He's not even a human. And he shows Dante there are nine more planets above. Nine more is exactly what I have in my hyperdimensional.
Well, wait. See, you're describing something that Robin has been trying to tell me through a totally different modality. She's been sending, and I know this sounds nuts, folks. I'm sorry. I'm just a reporter here. She's been sending numbers, David, like two realities that are mirror images of the other. And her coding is really, really sophisticated and consistent. And the model I've come up with is that she's currently living in an anti-reality of ours. But but in fact, it could be as physical as ours, except it's in a mirror parallel reality universe or a bud of.
Well, that's exactly what physicists, when antimatter was discovered and they were able to determine a complete antimatter hydrogen atom, the hypothesis was there must be antimatter people and antimatter solar system.
The problem is when you mix counter-terrain matter, which was the technical term, with normal matter, the matter we're made of,
right.
Huge, you know, explosion because you get total disintegration and conversion of mass into energy. So I'm thinking this is not the traditional, you know, antimatter, you know, negative protons, positive electrons, that kind of thing. This is a dimensional thing, but it opens up.
It's really weird because you're right. When matter and antimatter, if they meet, they'll convert to gamma, which is the brightest light that we know of. And I thought maybe that could explain for what happened in the miracle of the sun at Fatima. But if it was that much gammas, it would devastate everybody. And so that doesn't make sense. There must be either that or there's a way to hold a stable equilibrium between the two that we don't understand. At the same time, when you really count, like I use, let's go to my item four for a second. So
okay.
I looked at Yom Kippur, which is the most holy day for the ancient Hebrews, and I put it on from its lunar calendar from 1917, starting at Fatima, going forward 12 years to 1941. And what happens is it will line up with October 13th, about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, almost six times, about four times over a lunar cycle of 12 years. So again, Yom Kippur is a couple thousand years or more, is also in alignment to orbit planet 139 and lining up to the date of the miracle of the sun at Fatima. So why is that happening? It's almost as if they're praying to in alignment of this, again, interdimensional invisible portal that, or in hyperdimensional planet that orbits the sun every 139 to 144 days. And that number depends on where you start. If you start from December 25th or January 1st or January 7th, and you'll see you'll always be in the 98% accuracy to 139 days. So why Yom Kippur? I mean, this is getting even more amazing. And when you look,
okay, hang on, for people who aren't Jewish, define Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement of Sins, or the forgiveness of sins, which happens one day per year. Enter the Holy of Holies. So when Solomon's temple was standing, it was a cubic building that was 20 by 20 equivalent long, what are called long cubits or biblical cubits. And at the time of Moses, the Holy of Holies was a tent. And it was 10 by 10 cubits, which is actually the same measurement as the Queen's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, because they're long cubits. They're not short cubits. And that's in the book of Ezekiel that God only uses the cubit plus the hand, which would be equivalent to an Egyptian royal cubit. So why is the Holy of Holies, first of all, at the time of Moses, the same measurement as the Queen's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, and why you think that the Day of Atonement of Sins, which predates the birth of Christ and the ritual of Jesus being the forgiver of sins, why was it lining up to the orbit of planet 139, two orbits? Now, Jesus' Ascension Day, which is 40 days after Easter, and again, we're chasing the tail of Easter on a lunar calendar, but we actually know, this is the fact, that in the Julian calendar, Jesus's Easter was most, from all the math I've done, and I've got a whole huge piece of math on this, so it takes a while to go through it, but it's most likely the eclipse date we just had, April the 8th. The date we just had, April 8th, is either on the oldest calendar at the time that this actually happened. It's either the date of his crucifixion or it's the date of the original Easter on the solar calendar. So isn't that interesting? You have three eclipses, August 21st, mathematically proven. I can, you know, demonstrate. There's a whole paper on this, which in the Julian calendar was August the 8th, would become August 21st on our calendar. The second eclipse that we had to cross the Americas was, again, the anniversary of Fatima by one day, and I explained why it would be one day later, October 14th, 2023, was an annular eclipse. Notice it's an annular eclipse, too, because we are at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is David Sarita, and we're going through some kind of heavy numbers, but they add up to a pattern, a guided, recursive, coded pattern to survive the vagaries of history and tell us something amazing. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland.
The other side of midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, May 4th, 2024. My guest this morning is David Sarita. We're going over numbers that indicate, well, they indicate a lot because, A, they came from a hyperdimensional source, and, B, they're talking about something which is testable, constructible, and, C, they talk about a designer solar system in numbers and geometry, which may in fact be only one of two that are companioned between dimensions. And if that's true, I mean, David, if that's true, then we are in school.
Well, it's funny because the numbers have been staring at us like the two Fatimas for, well, since 1950, the second Fatima. And notice that Pope...
Where did Pope Pius write down his apparition and the description and all that? Because I've never heard anything about...
I can send you a whole article on it, and he has really good descriptions of it. What's amazing is when it happens a second time, it's kind of like, is he hallucinating? Why is this happening twice? And it's 1950, right? And then...
Yeah, 19.5. Come on.
Right. Oh,
yes. No, you missed that one. This is all hyperdimensional, and it's...
Which has the 591 in reverse. So
exactly. Yes, yes. Thank Crystal for that.
John Paul, his assassination attempt is May the 13th, which is the date that Mary first appears to the three children. And May 13th is one orbit of planet 139.
So that was not just an ordinary, if anything like an ordinary assassination. It was part of this ritual.
It's part of the ritual. It's May the 13th. John Paul, let me just look up the exact, I mean, I remember that. It wasn't. John Paul assassination attempt was the 13th of May, 1981. So remember, that's the date. Now watch what else winds up that, because Jesus' ascension day, again, it zigzags up and down on a calendar. I have a graphic of it up on my items. And you can see this graphic. I'm starting in the year 2017. I actually should have started in 1917, but
which one am I looking at?
It's called item. You're in item four. Look at the bottom.
The bottom blue graph.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jesus' Ascension Day, and you'll notice that at the bottom, his ascension day, again, periodically, will come into mid-May, right? And his ascension day is 40 days celebrated every year after Easter. Again, because we're chasing Easter on a lunar calendar. In fact, you know that the churches made an attempt to consolidate Easter to one absolute day per year,
yeah,
on our calendar, because they actually know that the lunar calendar is throwing us off, and they knew that they actually knew this, and it's quite shocking, but they knew that one of the contending dates for Easter would have been April 8th, the date of the eclipse that we just had.
As a permanent date.
As a permanent date, which would have been more, again, that's a corrected date, because you have that 13-year correction from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar, because we started using clocks and we started going off because we weren't using the sun, and the sun would have kept us at perfection. Absolutely would have kept us at perfection. But because we went off.
Yeah, but didn't they know in the mathematics that every 158 years you'd lose a day?
Well, no, every 158 years, yeah. I think the U.S. Naval Observatory knows that. Absolutely they know that.
How can everybody not know that?
They also know we're missing several minutes every year. So I have a chart here. So in 2007, we had to add 10.51 minutes. In 2008, we had to subtract 11.86 minutes. In 2009, we had to add 15.91 minutes. You see what I'm saying? And they don't know.
Well, wait. Of course they know. They just don't want us to know.
See? My missing planets would explain it. They would. I guarantee you they would. But we don't.
Well, think about this. On this side of the barrier, and I'm thinking of this as a barrier that it's very difficult to communicate across.
Yeah, sure.
On this side of the barrier, there was the war. Elements of this primordial school solar system, this celestial academy of physics and constants and modulations and all that was destroyed. But the other counterpart, the mirror image, is not. It's still intact. And there's somehow a migration.
That's a really brilliant thought right there. That is exactly what I think. I think my numbers in my so let's go to your website again, because what you said there is incredibly important. So if you go to my item 2 and click on the graphic, my hyperdimensional planets are above what I'm calling the firmament line. Those would be perfectly intact. So remember, my wife calls out my name at 591 days after August the 9th. And 591 divided by the golden ratio is 99.9999% accurate to Earth sidereal time. To Earth sidereal time, and which our calendar doesn't even know how to do. In fact, there is no 100% time, because we're off every year, plus or minus, which is corrected at the U.S. Naval Observatory. So the very fact that 591 divided by the golden ratio divided by the golden ratio divided by the golden ratio shows you the orbital periods to 98 to 99% accuracy of all the inner planets, including planet Vulcan, corrected in the annals of astronomy as being what's called a hypothetical planet. You know that Vulcan is a hypothetical planet because it was detected, and then they lost it, and then they detected it, and they lost it.
And the answer to that may be in the data from tomorrow night. Maybe. I am very much on the outer edge of the limb here. It's become a twig. But there is such astonishing data. David, this is really, because the data I've been getting from Robin is there's this mirror symmetry.
Right.
And, I mean, this is very now obvious as a trend in what she's been sending me. And if that's true, then that would be the equivalent of heaven.
Exactly, because the word heaven or Rados, and you know what's really disturbing for Christianity is all of the books in the New Testament were written in Greek. And if the Greeks recorded the word Ouranos for to mean heaven, Ouranos is a Greek god who cohabits with Gaia, Earth, to create the Titans, who then created the Olympians, who then created the human race. Well, that would go right out of play with the story of what we understand in Christianity, because also the meaning of heavens as Ouranos in Greek would be all the planets. And in fact, the word in Greek for planet and star, fixed and non-fixed star,
can interchangeably be very confusing when you look at the original Greek in, for example, the Book of Revelation, where it says there'll be a new heavens and a new earth. Now, if you go to my model, because this is right in line with Robin's, again, item two, what you see here is a pattern. Again, all I'm doing is taking 591 times the golden ratio, times the golden ratio, times the golden ratio, times the golden ratio to get to my outer planets. And the accuracy is sometimes 95% to the orbit, sometimes 98% to the orbit of the outer planets. Notice how it's not 100% perfect. But that's because there was, like you said, there was a disturbance, a war on what we'll call below the membrane or below the mirror.
Well, remember, we have this ancient cliche, as above, so below.
Right.
If we're dealing with mirror reality, hyperdimensional mirror reality, it would explain so much. It would, oh my gosh, it would explain.
You see, 91 divided by the golden ratio is 99.999% Earth. That is the most accurate. When I go to Venus, I'm at about 98% accuracy, and Mercury about 97.8% accuracy. I have an accuracy chart to this formula, which again would mean that the orbital periods for my planets above the line, remember, Dante has shown 9 more planets after he gets to the ninth position, which would be Neptune, even though there was no Neptune. We couldn't see Neptune at the time of Dante. We couldn't see Uranus at the time of Dante. We could only see Saturn, you know, as far as Saturn. But the fact that Jesus shows him 9 more planets, and I've got 9 more planets above the line, if you count them. But notice when you get to Earth and Venus, we've got 2 planets in a row below the line, which would mean that if you read the Book of Revelation, the prophecy is there'll be a new heaven and new earth, meaning the old heavens will pass away. Remember, heavens are planets. They're not abject, meaning unknowable places. They're actually planets. So in order for Earth to suddenly not see the planets below the line and suddenly see new heavens above the line, it would have to ascend into this hyperdimensional state where it no longer sees the planets below the line and sees all these new ones above it. That's revelation. That's the prophecy. And when I look at the pattern,
that sounds to me in the physics like a frequency shift.
It sounds like a frequency shift, exactly. It sounds like Earth, in prophecy, people talk about this all the time, that we're going to, you know, some of us will jump to the fifth dimensional Earth and the rest of us will be left behind in the dust, right? So either Earth split.
Well, now that opens up a can of worms. But
like I'm going to talk about tomorrow night. By the way, you're joining us, right? Because I need you out.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
I'm going to try to set a context. And as I said at the top of the show, the parallel between 68 with the celestial backdrop to stunning political foment and uprisings and unrest and realignments and all of that. I mean, this is an eerie parallel because the stuff on the celestial plane, which is going to change everything, is so mind-blowingly confirmable. This is not like a big secret. It's like a big, why didn't we see that before?
And I know, why didn't you see this before is remember also in my item three, this was in Lemaitre's work, The Great Pyramid Decoded, what he called the Bethlehem line coming out of the Great Pyramid at 26.3 degrees goes right through Bethlehem. And the Tome of Juan Diego, which is a huge story, it's an enormous story because it's real. It manifested winter solstice in 1531. But winter solstice in 1531 was December 12th, and then now it's the 22nd on our current calendar. But when I did this study on the Tome of Juan Diego too,
because there was an argument that her head is tilted at the angle of Earth, Earth's axial tilt, which is...
No, wait, who are you referring to? Who's Juan...
The gentleman of Juan Diego is there would be no Mexico today if it wasn't for the Tome of Juan Diego. The Tome of Juan Diego manifests this local Indian in a village just north of Mexico City in the year of 1591, literally starts getting visitations by the Mother Mary. She appears to him. She appears to him a number of times, and then she... Because, of course, his local church doubts him and thinks that he's making stuff up, she tells him to bring this cloth that is made out of agave cactus fiber and fill it with all these flowers that are blooming in the time of winter, which is impossible, all these beautiful roses. And he brings them to the church, and the roses fall on the floor, and several witnesses, including the head of the church, sees the image of the Mother Mary appears on Tilma. But Tilma is more visited every year than the Great Pyramid of Egypt, because you can imagine that. That's because of how many people live in Mexico City. But
this is the cloth he was carrying, and they picked up the roses and the other flowers, and then she
disappeared. It was this blinding light that comes out of her. And notice, first of all, I corrected the angle that her head is tilted at. It's not tilted at Earth 23.5. It's tilted at 26.3 degrees. The angle that represents the hidden interdimensional planet. But again, if I click on the full image of her, she has 139 to 140 radiant lines coming off of her body. And I spent a lot of time counting these things. Because if you look at the bottom, and this is in my item, you can see this in item 4. It's an image off to the right. If you click on this image of the full Tilma, notice there's a black crescent moon supposedly under her feet that's hidden by her robe that this angel is lifting up.
Is this the full painting?
This is not the full painting. You're missing part of the top and part of the bottom.
But you have seen the full real one.
I have the full one in a book, which is what I used to count.
Okay. Have you counted the stars?
Yes, the stars have been counted. And you should see how much they know about the Tilma. But notice the black crescent moon. You do not get a black crescent moon in an eclipse unless you add a third body,
right?
A third planetary body. It's impossible that you would get a white crescent moon during a solar eclipse.
Right, right.
You would a third body, a hidden body, to pass over in order for a black crescent to appear. I've got pieces of paper here. I've done it, and I've shown it to people online because we don't have visual tonight for me to demonstrate this. And nobody noticed that. I mean, you know how much money, how many physicists and scientists have studied the Tilma? Because the Tilma won't rot. It's dated. It's made out of agave fibers. It's dated to December 12, 1331. It's impossible that it would still be intact. There's no paint. The image is not painted on there. Somebody tried to blow it up with a stick of dynamite, and it didn't do anything to it. And also somebody spilled acid on it and nothing happened to it. It's a miraculous, and there's reflections in her eyes of all the witnesses standing around her that have been blown up with super standing photographic techniques. Point is, her head is tilted at 26.3 degrees, and she has, I counted 139 radiance lines. I mean, I've counted it so many times. I mean, it could be 140 because there's some hidden underneath the angel, but I've measured and adjusted for them. So again, why 139 and why a black crescent? Because you cannot produce a black crescent without the aid of a third planetary body in your eclipse. And we don't know how that could happen unless this hyperdimensional planet would just possibly appear on these great period cycles.
Well, I may have an answer for that tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Isn't this a merciless tease?
We'll be there.
Oh, wait till you
see item five. Item five. Let me know when you're ready for item five.
I'm ready. Ready. I'm ready. Go for it.
Item five is really going to blow your mind. So remember, our three eclipses in America were August 21st, and then they was October 14th, the anniversary of Fatima, and April 8th was Easter. Probably when the church has tried to resolve a single date for Easter, it's one of the dates they consider to be the true date of Easter on its soul.
Well, do you know why that's really, really, really interesting? I'm trying to remember which of my many sources, because I have like this, you know, volunteer intelligence network. People send me really cool stuff. And I normally don't talk about them unless they give me permission, because I did that years ago with something really important. And the poor guy absolutely freaked out because he wasn't supposed to tell me what he had told me. And I didn't know. He didn't say, don't tell anybody. Don't tell who told you. He must have missed that. Anyway. So I can't really identify who pointed this out to me, but it might have been Rick Levine, which is a public person, so I can name him. Because he said that this eclipse, the April 8th eclipse, occurred when the moon and, of course, the sun were at 19.5 degrees, actually 19.47, and change from the first point of Aries, which of course is the point of spring on March 21st, 22nd. That is not accidental. That's part of the design. And so the church wanting to put Easter permanently there, you begin to see a plot, David?
Good, and that's 591 in reverse. So
yeah, well, that was Crystal giving you the backwards part of the same gestalt. We're dealing with good information, even if our sourcing is beyond belief.
Incredible. So item five, there are three graphics. Now, these, I was so stunned by these, right? I was so stunned by them. So let's start with the bottom one of the three. So remember, I can start my year on January 7th, which is Orthodox Christmas, which again is 3 days after perihelion. Some years, 3 days is the 6th of January. Some it's the 7th. In some Orthodox churches, they celebrate Christmas January 6th, and some Orthodox churches, January the 7th. Now, I'm going to add 591 days for the 591 days after my wife died, and I'm using this add or subtracted number of days to date calculator. It's August 21st.
Oh, my.
Now that's stunning, because remember, the first eclipse was August 21st.
Yep.
That's the mathematically corrected date on our calendar for Jesus' birthday, and there's a whole paper written on this, but it's also my birthday. So did my wife call out my name 591 days after she died? And it shows up perfectly in this calculation. Now I'll go to the middle graphic. And now I'm going to take January 7th, and I'm using the year 1961, the year I was born. I'm going to minus 139 days for planet 139. It's August 21st again.
Oh, my.
You see what I mean? I'm using dates for my hyperdimensional planet orbit. And I've already demonstrated how planet 139 lines up with everything, Jesus' ascension.
So why should this be revolving around your birthday?
Jesus' real birthday is what I'm saying. But again, all I'm doing, I'm starting on January the 7th. This is Orthodox Christmas. And actually, you know what? If you take December 25th, in the old Julian calendar, and you come forward, your number of correction dates for the Gregorian calendar, you're at January 7th. If you take December 25th on the old Roman calendar as a Roman solar holiday for the new year, you will come to January 7th on our calendar. Yet on our calendar, December 25th still, again, 3 days and nights, which is 4,320 minutes, 432, which is how many minutes you get in 3 days. Remember, Jesus said the 3 days and the three nights. So you're at the end of winter solstice plus 3 days. You're December 25th. You go to winter perihelion, which changes between the 22nd and 23rd of January every year, and you add 3 days, and you're at January 6th or 7th. So, again, that's all I'm doing. I'm starting on January 7th again, and all I've done is I've subtracted 139 days for the planet 139. I'm at August 21st. So now, on my first graphic, I'm going to start at January 7th, and I'm going to take Venus's. Now, Venus is not a full 225 days, but I'm going to add 225 days for Venus to January 7th. I'm at August 20th. So that's a visible planet. What is going on here? Why do I keep coming up to August 20th, 21st? Why? All I'm doing, you see the design here? And again, you go back to our eclipse. Now this is really going to hit home here, because you go back to the three eclipses and you have all 3 dates. August 21st. Now, you know what else happened? I forgot to mention this, and you're going to love this. Is Oumuamua was coming in during that eclipse, and it was publicized upper mid-October 2017 is when astronomers told us that Oumuamua was coming in.
Yeah, well, the guys in Hawaii saw it. They didn't know it was appearing. They just caught it by accident on the, I forget what network they photographed, deep space. So, you know, but yeah, definitely.
It was coming. It would have been coming in during the eclipse.
Of course it would have been. It would have, you know exactly where it would have been. It would have been above the ecliptic, plunging down toward the ecliptic at 33 degrees, remember?
33 again. There's a 33 again. So
it's all about the physics.
Can you see August 21st? This was a design.
This is where Abby Loeb is. So it's like he's got the trail, but he doesn't have the scent.
No.
He knows Oumuamua is important, but he has no idea how radically outside the box important it is, unless he does, and his job is to stamp out burning ducks. Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour. So everybody just kind of, you know, chill just a little bit, maybe take a drink of water, go to the kitchen, go anywhere else you need to go to, because this is not trivial stuff. This is mind-bending, history-changing, calendar-warping code down through hundreds of years, if not much, much longer. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland.
We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this still Saturday night, about a half hour left to the wishing hour, the witching hour. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is David Sarita, and we're kicking around the idea that there are clues, both empirical clues you're going to see tomorrow night, and mathematical and cyclic clues buried in a whole raft of art, culture, literature, religious ceremony, pageantry, calendrical dates, feast days, every way possible that the human race could memorialize that which at all costs it was never supposed to forget. And we forgot.
Right there.
Well, I just find this amazing because this is almost like a time-release aspirin clock where if you get the right, combinations and you insert the right numbers in the equation, the tapestry of history, the suppressed history, who we really are, what we're reaching toward, what we're trying to reconnect with, kind of just all falls out of the numbers.
Well, it's this thing about August 21st is quite stunning. It's got me stumped. It's not just because it's my birthday. It's more about why, when I started January 7th and I add and subtract. In fact, I've done this for a lot of the planets above the line. I did it for the next one above the line, and I got August 21st again. And I'm really, really stunned by this and what it could mean. I mean, how could the Urantia book, which gets published, the Urantia book in my scientific mind would be, because it was channeled in Chicago in the 1920s, and it was, this man goes into, these two doctors, a man and a woman couple, notice this guy, and they find out he's going into this altered state of consciousness. And it also gets published October 12th, 1955. And there's that date again, October 12th, 13th. And it says Jesus is born on August 21st. And who would believe this? I mean, it's channeled, right? You would think this isn't scientific. But why do the numbers add up? And why, in this incredible study establishing the date of Jesus' birth using scripture and mathematics, that he would have been born, they don't have it to the date. They have it to the week of August 13th in 5 BC Julian calendar, right? So August the 8th, which would equal the 21st in today's calendar, would fit right in there very, very nicely.
Of course.
They don't have it to the exact date, but they're using scripture and they're using mathematics and orbitals to determine. Actually, in the original Gospel of Matthew, which was the only gospel used at the time of the first church, which was headed by Jesus' brother James, there was a different understanding of what his birth meant. It meant the date he was anointed by the Holy Spirit and became fully illuminated and started his mission, and that would have been December 25th on the old calendar, and that would be January 7th and the 6th, depending on where perihelion sits in a given year, because it goes backwards and forwards today, on today's calendar. So that means, again, you look at these three eclipses, how did this manifest? So you got a bubble coming in.
Because you live in a designer solar system.
Exactly.
What I'm amazed about, David, is that entropy, noise, jitter, friction, whatever interactive force that makes things not perfect you want to invoke, from the time when this was established to now, like a few weeks ago, April 8th, that timing has not moved. That's an incredible precision for a system which is entropic and not known for recited their dates to keep moving around, and they, whoever they are, don't understand the physics of celestial mechanics. Why? It just appears to be, it's almost like we're in some kind of a still semi-self-correctable situation to where these dates are fixed by resonance patterns that are really long, long lived. So we see the pattern and we can back engineer why the pattern exists and how old it might be.
So watch this, because you go, let's jump way forward now, because I can, I think I brought this up on your show before, but I didn't really show much of it, which is if you start at 1917, the year of Fatima, and you just make a graph and you just keep adding 5 years. So 1917, 1922, 1927, 1932, 1937, 1942, 1947. Everybody knows those years. And you keep going. And you'll see all the biggest UFO sightings that we've recorded, including Roswell, the Phoenix Lights. But I'm going to come to a particular one that I really like. So you come to, in my algorithm, 2007 is the Chicago O'Hare UFO is November 7th, 2006, but Stephenville, Texas has two sightings and the dates are stunning. The first date of the Stephenville UFO was actually Christmas Day, 2007. And Christmas Day, 2007, which is in my algorithm. And the next sighting at Stephenville was January the 8th, 2008. Now, why those two dates? Remember, December 25th and January 7th are these two interchangeable dates that two different church systems use to celebrate Christmas, which, according to the original Matthew, was Jesus's anointing day, the day he was baptized by John the Baptist and received his illumination and the Holy Spirit. So, which would equal January 7th. And guess what? We're so close to it being January the 8th, actually. When I do my calculation with my 158 years, we're the better part of we should be at almost a January 8th right now. So what interests me about the Stephenville case is it has those two dates for two major sightings, December 25th. And this was in the documentary produced by Steven Spielberg. And it's really interesting because the first sighting by the deer hunter, and they just said it was 2 weeks before the main sighting on January the 8th. Well, 2 weeks before is Christmas Day. So, but they don't say that. Maybe they didn't want to because it might upset Christians that there was a UFO in Stephenville. And this was, Stephenville's was witnessed by over 300 people. There are not very many UFO sightings that have that many witnesses to a single event, right? And actually, 2017 is in my five-year algorithm, as is 2012, the end of the Mayan calendar. So remember, in 2012, was celebrated on April the 8th, the day of the eclipse. And Oumuamua was coming in 2017, which was the August 21st eclipse, is in my five-year algorithm. Notice it's in my five-year algorithm. So all I did is I started at 1917 plus 5 years, plus 5 years.
Why did you pick 5 years?
Something just told me. I get these. It's
that's
just like
half a decade.
Something told me, add up all the angles of all the planets in the solar system and look at the number. You'll know what it means. When I saw it, I knew what that meant. I knew that you only needed, you know, the missing angle, which is the slope angle of the Great Pyramid of Egypt, 0.3 degrees to complete the circle. I knew that as soon as I was looking at 333.7 degrees for all the planets in the solar system. So again, when I do this five-year algorithm, I come to 1932, the UFO crash in Italy, reported in Popular Mechanics, 1937, 5 years later, the alien saucer crash in Nazi Germany, 1937, shaped like a bell, which is the Nazi bell, plus 5 years, 1942, the Battle of Los Angeles, UFOs over Redondo Beach, Hermosa Beach. We fired 1,400 rounds at them, plus 5 years, 1947, which is Canton Island and Roswell and Maury Island. Plus 5 years is the UFOs over the U.S. Capitol, July 12th to the 29th. What's interesting about those guys, the famous sighting of the U.S. Capitol, is we're only months before the detonating the first H-bomb, because that would have been early November 1952. And then you go another 5 years, and you have the level in Texas, 200-foot-long egg-shaped UFOs. Another 5 years, you get to Betty and Barney Hill. I'm off by less than a year. Then another 5 years, Sag Harbor, very famous case. Another 5 years, 1972, the McCord UFO encounter. Another 5 years, the big 1977 missing time incident at Ellsworth Air Force Base, nuclear incident, Tehran. The Tehran Triangles was actually 1976. And the Broadhaven, UK mass UFO sighting triangle was 1977.
Yeah, but wait. It's possible.
I'm just going every 5 years.
Yeah, but it's possible to take any of all those classic UFO sightings, and if the dates were different, the sightings would be different. In other words, how do you know there's any kind of correlation?
Oh, these are the big ones. Like the Hudson Valley, again, that's 1982, five more years. That's the beginning of the Hudson Valley sightings.
Okay.
With the Kent Cliffs. I mean, these are the big ones, Richard. There are lots of little ones, right? Gulf Breeze, Florida begins five more years, 1987.
So we got a pattern. What does the pattern mean?
Well, the pattern, I actually got to get it right down to the day, but the problem with getting these down to the day is they're not all recorded to the day. In fact, the Phoenix Lights, 1997, which was massive, is in my five-year algorithm, right? Like, how could all of the big ones? I think the only one I missed was the one at that military base in the United Kingdom. I'm trying to remember the name of that one. That one is out of phase. I mean, could it be that the planets have to be in
Rensselaer Forest,
Rensselaer Forest? Yeah, that's the one that I can't fit. Right, it doesn't fit.
Right.
Well, what's that
and
coming?
Well, I believe there are certain UFOs that are ours coming from Earth-based, and some of those Earth-based may not be our military, but maybe ancient remnants of ancient civilizations, which is a hypothesis actually put forward members of the Pentagon, actually, in reports I've read. There is an acceptance that there may be remnants of an ancient mythic civilization that are kind of clandestine, living on our planet and remaining very, you know, elusive. So you have those that are Earth-based are not going to follow these algorithms. But these algorithms, because I'm starting in 1917, the miracle of the sun, would be in a five-year harmony of planet 139. That's what that would mean. So what does 5 to the orbit of 139 mean? That's what I have to figure out next. I mean, one thing I've done is I've actually taken apparitions of the Mother Mary that are recorded, very, very famous apparitions. They're actually recorded, and I can see when she comes in, when she goes out. These are well recorded with dates, like Medjugorje and in Egypt, in a district of Cairo called Zaytun, in 1968, it made all the newspapers. It made the New York Times that the Mother Mary was appearing above these Coptic churches, shining, you know, like the sun. And photographers took pictures of her, and there were UAP luminous orbs up in the sky above her, and the dates she comes in on are perfect. I mean, these are perfect dates. So that means there has to be some harmonic interplay going on and for these events to occur that involves my invisible hyperdimensional planets as well as visible, right? As well as visible. Like if I take on my calculator a 365.256 sidereal year minus my planet 139.51, I get the orbit of Venus, 225. How could that be? How is that? I mean, again, if you read the Book of Revelation, is one of those books that have in prophecy and vision, like Dante, because Dante's visions are recordings of the spirit living and ascending through the known planets with invisible kingdoms on those planets. And Dante's experiences are real experiences that for him. They are not scientifically provable, but for him, he wrote poems about his experiences going through them. But also in the Book of Revelation, for example, Jesus declares that he is the bright and morning star. So therefore, he is Venus, because Venus is to the ancient Greeks the bright and morning star. And of course, the New Testament was written in Greek. So Venus being in perfect harmony proportionally to 139, because it's the leftover of a 365.256 day year, minus 139.51, you get 225.74. So that's Venus. So that would mean that it's kind of like a vibrational proportional ratio that almost happens musically, frequency-wise, between planets that allows an inflow and an outflow. Yeah, well, that's the way it would work.
It would be a resonance pattern between dimensions and
what dimensions?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, this idea of the mirror reality, that's been a very major theme of a lot of stuff that Robin has sent me over the last 5 years. I can't believe it's 5 years. 5 years. And there's been a big shift this year, which I'm going to quietly pursue. And if there are positive developments, I will let people know. But this is pretty, pretty bizarre.
You know, it takes years. I mean, my mother, who was a California attorney, this really happened. It took over 3.5 years. It was the morning of the insurrection of the Capitol. It was January 6th, and we know what January 6th is now, right? And I have my electronic frequency staff.
Right.
Can you hear me? And it's transmitting a frequency and I hear this static AM radio station in the middle of the night coming from my staff. And I get up, and there's my mom. It's 4 a.m, so the insurrection of the Capitol hadn't happened yet. And I can see her. She looks 20 years old again, head to toe, with my eyes open, out of body, I'm not dreaming. There's my mom, totally rejuvenated. And it's interesting because my mom in the 60s dyed her hair blonde, but her hair was brown, chestnut brown, the way it naturally is.
Huh.
And she looked even more beautiful than she did when she was alive. And she's right next to my staff, right? And actually, Jesus in Mark 6, 1 through 8, actually tells the apostles, you have to have your staff with you. You know, when I'm gone, I'm resurrected, you got to have your staff. So maybe it's an afterlife. Maybe it's a communication tool, why you see the staff in the pyramids with all the great ancient Egyptian, you know, deities and kings and queens. So anyway, there's my mom. But I actually did a calculation from the day she died, which was the 14th of September of the year. I don't have the year in front of me right now, to the date of the apparition. And it was a perfect harmony of 139, meaning 139 divided into it perfectly with no leftover numbers.
Mm.
So, oh my God, my mother even, when she's appearing to me in this full apparition, which is fully luminous, and actually she sat on the bed and the bed went down.
Oh my gosh, that was one of my, that was when Robin left wherever we are. She did it twice. Her side of the bed went down and I woke up. And I was so weirded out that the first time I just went back to sleep. I said, oh, I'm just having a dream. And then it happened again exactly the same way. And, of course, I realized, no, I'm having some kind of experience. And that was the last manifestation here of her departure. And it was literally at the winter solstice. That aligned.
So did you get the date of that experience was winter solstice?
Yes, it was the 22nd.
Well, if you're the 22nd, then your harmony is the sun. If it's December 22nd, is then... See,
well, she sent me a whole bunch of stuff about the eclipse. I may get into a couple things tomorrow night. The bottom line is, it's like she's been trying to communicate there's another level of reality. There's a huge barrier in between. But together with your work, I'm thinking that this is a mirror image manifestation between places that are basically identical, except that one is not this one, and this one is not that one.
Winter solstice, and that's when the Mother Mary appeared to Juan Diego. What was the date of her death? I'll tell you the numbers. What's the date of her death? You have that?
No. Oh, Robin?
Yeah.
Oh, the 3rd of March. And
March?
At 3rd of March at dawn, 33, 2019.
I have a calculator here. It's an online calculator. 2019, and then what's the date?
The 3rd of March.
No, the 3rd of March to the winter solstice, which is the, of what year?
Oh, the same year.
Oh, March 3rd, 2019 to December.
Remember, 6 days after she died, she sent me that picture, which has stunning implications of all the things.
The number of days.
Go ahead.
294 days. So 294, oh, my God, that's, Richard, 294 divided by 139.51 is 2.1 orbits of 139. That's really high accuracy for two orbits. So I would go, watch this, 139. I'll tell you the accuracy. Divided by... Oh, my God, that's incredible. That's incredible. You see how it's a harmony? Like 279 would be perfect, exactly, too. But you're in the high 90s there, like of percent accuracy from her death to when the
effort. Yeah, remember Hoagland's first law, all science is approximate.
Well, our time is approximate.
Well, because of entropy. It's entropy. It's noise. It's losses in the system. You know, it can never be perfect. There's always going to be an error.
Well, it's not really an error. It's like you think of tuning an instrument musically. Nobody can tune an instrument 100% accurately.
No, that's the same thing. You know, it's a resonance thing.
Yeah.
So as we used to say, close enough for folk music.
It's better than folk music. that's actually phenomenal. I mean, it's really phenomenal that the perfection of that is about 98% accurate.
Well, we know that it's on the same wavelength, pun intended.
You see how it happens, though? Why is it in harmony with two orbits of 139, the dates between Robin's death and this. And notice it's physical. You said the bed went down. I mean, when the bed went down, my mom sat next to me.
Twice. For me, it was twice. I was like, fine. You idiot. You know, wake up. So it did it again.
And it took me years to figure this out because the insurrection of the Capitol happened later that day. And I didn't even realize it was Orthodox Christmas on January the 6th for Armenian Orthodox people. And the very next day, of course, would be Orthodox Christmas,
right? Right.
Which would later be a remarkable date. So, but the fact that it's winter solstice is even more amazing. Why does the Mother Mary come to Juan Diego on winter solstice? It's said to do this huge apparition. Because there are certain dates that are in perfect harmony where they can come in and then they can go out. And I've seen a lot of the Marian apparitions. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they'd line up with, and I can pull the numbers up, but they'd line up with Venus and Planet 139 regularly. It is quite regular that this actually occurs. So the question is, why? Is why does a harmony matter for an incoming spiritual being to appear? In fact, when Mary appears,
because it's a resonance in a physic. That's how.
I mean, when she appeared in Zaitun, Egypt, she was photographed. There were over a million witnesses to her luminous body hovering above the top of the Coptic church with these glowing orbs in the sky above her. I mean, it wasn't a private interior apparition. Like I could say, me hearing a locution, the voice of my wife calling me out 591 days
out. And what's so interesting, and we're now at the top of the hour, so we'll pick this up on the other side. But to me, what's so remarkably interesting is that this all appears to be some kind of pattern to code the importance of these resonance nodes in the physics. In other words, what we are thinking of as a spiritual or maybe an occult kind of, apparition is in fact part of a larger physics, which involves the display or transport or communication or evolution or mediation or dislocation or relocation of beings which are actually, you know, corporeal in some other dimension. And that is absolutely bizarre.
Yeah, I'll demonstrate that when we come back. I'm going to show you a simple one-paragraph formula that starts...
Okay, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is David Sarita, last hour to go. If you want to join the conversation, when we come back, I'll give out the phone numbers, and I have a couple of ideas about who might call in, because this is up their alley as well. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Our guest tonight is David Sarita, showing the fact that we may be living in a mirror, a broken mirror solar system compared to what? That's the question, isn't it? We shall return.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio with pictures on demand. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone. The Other Side of Midnight. It is now Sunday morning here in the Land of Enchantment, so our Saturday night Sunday program continues, about an hour left. Let me give you some numbers here.
Let me give you a number. Important. Or why can't I see the right number? Oh, there we are. There.
If you want to join the conversation, if you have some questions to ask of David, which encompass questions that I may not get to because we have a lot, you might want to call area code 917-889-8802. 917-889-8802. And that will directly connect you with us through Blog Talk. In the meantime, so David, where are we left? Well, I mean, my conclusion is that, A, we're in a designer solar system, and B, the next job is to figure out why.
Well, it's been my entire passion since the beginning of my appearances on Art Bell to prove that which is invisible. In fact, I started with Art Bell on the ultraviolet, near and far sensitive video cameras that were on board the space shuttle that were picking up anomalous UFO activity on those missions and that were recorded. And to mathematically detect planets that are not there, but to be able to detect their orbits with a formula that involves the golden ratio. And we see the golden ratio everywhere in the natural world. We see it in the spiral arms of the Milky Way galaxy itself. And to use that with a mythic number that comes from my wife, 591, 19.5, to reveal periods of invisible planets that line up to religious specific holy dates is something really, really remarkable. And it can't be overlooked. I mean, this really needs a really good astronomer to understand the theory of antimatter planets. In fact, the physicists in the company of those who agree with antimatter planets and antimatter people and antimatter solar systems and even galaxies are divided quite equally. You could find physicists that would say that that's hogwash, and then you'll find a real physicist who's published articles on it, actually, which I've read, that say that it's not hogwash. It's actually very real because we can photograph antimatter. You can actually photograph it, and antimatter appears when we accelerate matter to very high levels of energy, which means high frequency, because frequency and energy are proportional in Max Planck's E equals HF formula. So we would say that at a very high frequency, antimatter appears. In fact, antimatter is generated on what are called terrestrial gamma ray flashes during super lightning strikes that hit the Earth every day. So the Earth always is generating and annihilating antimatter. It has a very, very tiny amount of antimatter all the time. And theoretically, the antimatter universe would have mostly antimatter and a tiny, tiny bit of matter. And that tiny, tiny bit of matter and antimatter in an asymmetry between universes could act as a bridge periodically. And that periodically, there was an event after the eclipse on what's called the Ventusky weather app that relies on NOAA and US
geological satellites to collect data. And this went viral. This story went everywhere. This huge apparition appears about a day after the eclipse, so around the 9th of April. And it looks like two Vesica Pisces-shaped apparently it's in the Ventusky. I've actually got the Ventusky app on my computer. So it's when it's in wave mode and it's looking at...
No, wait. Back at the beginning. What is this app measuring? Because you sent me a graph. It wasn't really very clear what it was. But the one thing that I instantly noticed was the graph, the shape of the graph, was identical with the Accutron measurements I've done for...
Oh, no, that's a different one. That's a different one. That's the time shift. No, this is...
Yeah, but the time shift measured in what? What were they measuring?
That's the Keith. That Keith would have to look in his emails. It's before all my items. It's the subject is Ventusky. It says last item of Ventusky anomaly. So I wish you could see this so we could put it up on the screen. But this actually, the story went to international headlines. The company that makes the app said it was an anomaly.
What app are we talking? What does the app look at? What does it show us?
It looks at weather.
It looks at weather around the planet?
All over the planet.
Okay.
Very global.
So what was unusual? What was unusual? What was unusual about the weather on Earth on the 9th of April?
So you go to Ventusky.com.
What is Ventusky? You're mentioning things.
It's a app that looks at weather. It looks at temperature, precipitation, radar, satellite, clouds, wind speed, wind gusts, air pressure, thunderstorms, humidity, snow cover, air quality. It has all these different.
So you can call up weather for any place on the Earth, right?
Well, you can look at the whole Earth. I'm looking at the whole Earth right now on Ventusky.com.
Okay.
And I click on C. So you click on C, you'll see all the waves, right? But on about April the 9th, after one day after the eclipse, the C app went crazy because it showed this massive wave structure in the shape of two interfacing Vesica Pisces down in the southern African coast, off of the South African coast, and it made headlines all over the world. People were going crazy over this thing. And
was there anything going on in the real ocean? Because apps are just digital, you know, manifestations of somebody's imagination.
Well, they're drawing their data from NOAA satellites,
right?
And data gets put up, and it's seeing something. So remember what I said. Let's go back to what I said before I mentioned Ventusky, because remember that there's always...
Well, the NOAA satellites have two main measurement systems. They have cameras, and then they have infrared sensors. So the infrared sensors are measuring temperature. So was this Vesica Pisces mirrored? There's the mirror again. Was it sea surface temperature anomalies off South Africa?
It was sea wave anomalies that were enormous waves.
Well, you can't see those from geosynchronous orbit. Somebody had to have plotted them from much closer to the ocean.
So try to just postulate the idea that data came in that wasn't physically there. But it picked it up, but it wasn't physically there. So remember what I said. There's always a tiny bit of antimatter on Earth at all times. It's coming and going and coming and going, coming and going.
I don't think this has anything to do with antimatter. Zero, zero, zero.
Yeah, it might not.
It can't. You know why? Because antimatter and matter destroy. If we're talking about mirrored hyperdimensional realities, forget the idea of antimatter. That's in 3D. This is a dimensional shift that's mirrored between non-physical dimensions as we rate our 3D reality. This is light years bigger than, you know, antimatter in three dimensions.
Yeah. Remember, It could be a, imagine two spheres. So just imagine two spheres. One is visible and one is invisible, and they barely cross each other's path, and they leave a tracer. And the weather instruments pick it up, and we say, oh, that must be an anomaly.
No, wait, wait. When you say they're not visible or they're...
No, one of them is not visible.
All right.
There's
well, hang on. Would each one be invisible from the other perspective, the other dimension?
Barely.
And the only way you can figure out they're there is either through the math or some leakage of information between the two realities, or the fact that they are mirrored and they're connected and they can never get lost, but the communication between them can become almost impossible. And again, we're looking at wave phenomenon, cycles. Some cycles are good, some cycles are bad, that kind of thing.
Well, remember that the strange quark always is leaving and coming back and leaving and coming back in every atom and everything that everything's made out of. And nobody knows where they go and how they come back, but they come back and they leave and they come back. So every system has to have an inflow and an outflow, even if that in and outflow is tiny, just like a lake has a river coming in and a river goes out.
Well, we don't have a lot of time. It's amazing. We don't have a lot of time.
How much time do we have?
Well, about 15 minutes to the bottom of the hour, and then we got a half hour to finish up. But I want to raise an idea. Suppose on some kind of hyperdimensional clock, in the nature of reality, the way these systems are interacting at a fundamental etheric or trans-etheric level, suppose every so many cycles or so many intervals, each four-dimensional universe for an instant, for an interval, whatever, can see the other.
Right.
The invisible becomes visible.
Right.
That's
just
the,
like Robin sat on your bed. Yeah.
Yes, that's the phenomenon I'm seeing in the outer solar system, which is
right.
Boggling my mind, because it's like, how can I be the first person to see this? Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people, amateur astronomers, have looked at this stuff, and nobody is reporting it.
I can't wait to hear this tomorrow night.
It's so obvious. It's like I'm saying to myself, am I the only idiot here, or are we looking at a phenomenon which comes and goes? So rare when it comes, it's been dismissed as an apparition, as a figment of people's imaginations, as bad memory, as equipment failure, as anything but what it really is.
Just like the Ventovsky event, they said it's an anomaly of the software. This can't be possibly happening because it's showing up, but we don't know why this is here, and it shouldn't be here, so we'll just make it go away.
In
science, you never throw out data. You keep it. Even if you don't understand it, you keep it.
That's only theoretically good science. How many scientists really are that virtuous? Anyway, so this gets back to signals, signatures, leakage that our reality is in a larger reality, and there is communication between those two realities. And you've experienced one set, and I'm experiencing another set.
And one of the ways in the ancient world, because they didn't have radios, but they did have a brain and an antenna, and it was called a staff. Watch this. This is one paragraph. So the staff of Aaron was 2.5 cubits because, according to the Bible, it lay in the 2.5 cubit Ark of the Covenant. Now watch what happens. An antenna at 2.5 cubits.
So a 2.5 cubit is something like a 9 feet tall.
No, it's a royal cubit. It's always a royal cubit. So 2.5 cubits is like 4.3.
Okay.
So an antenna, a monopole antenna, transmits a wavelength 4 times the height. So a 2.5 cubit produces a wavelength of 10 royal cubits. And then which is the 10 row qubits, then times, I have this formula right here. I'll do it in reverse. 591 divided by the golden ratio, 1.618033987 equals 365.258. That's sidereal Earth time accurate to 99.99%.
By the stars.
Right. Divided by the square root of pi, which is 1.772453, equals pi, by the way. So pi is 3.14159. To equals 206.0748, a whole bunch of decimals. It is 10 royal cubits, the measurement of Moses' Holy of Holies. And the measurement of Moses' Holy of Holies divided by 4 equals the length of the staff. So proportionally, the staff communicates all the way to 591 perfectly. Perfectly. Now, I know I can show this math to any mathematician. I mean, I'm speaking it on a radio show, so you may not quite get it. But when you understand why Jesus in Mark 6:1-8, 6:1-8 is the golden ratio, by the way, he tells the apostles, no money in your purse, no bread, just your staff when I disperse you. That staff was made of metal. It was not a piece of wood. It's very clear in the books of Moses that God told Moses to wrap a copper coil as a serpent around a pole, which is how the very first radio was ever made. I remember making radio myself, you know, wrapping copper wire around a toilet paper roll. That's basically what God told Moses to do, is to make a radio. If the height is 2.5 cubits, it's perfectly proportional to 591, the number of days my wife called out my name. So when you see this over and over and over again, like if I could only demonstrate this once or maybe twice and find some little coincidence here and there, then I would just arrest my case and say, you know, I don't have enough data here to put forward a theory like this. But when you understand that we have the ability to detect that which is not visible in physics, that we know scientifically that the invisible is real because it has an effect on the visible, because we know that there are planetary time anomalies in the inner solar system that shift our time every year, and we can't mathematically quantify it, but we know it's happening. And then tomorrow night, you're going to go into the outer solar system. Mm-hmm. And when you see tiny anomalies, and you consider that the invisible physical realities can very weakly, I'll say weakly, interact with the visible, in the same way photons.
Mm-hmm. Maybe not, David, because what I found, there are times when they interact overwhelmingly. But because those times are so rare, everybody who sees them doesn't believe them.
Right.
It's like they all think they're crazy.
They're looking at their watch, and the watch has done the same thing for 100-something years, and then it does something else. And then when it does something else, they think there's something wrong with their instruments.
Well, that was Maurice Allais's experience in that laboratory in 1954 in Paris, France. Actually in a basement under Paris, France, because he was measuring something with a pendulum, required constant loving care. He couldn't mechanically set it up so it would do it automatically. So it required an operator to release and stop a pendulum over many, many, many hours, 10, 12, 14 hours. So this scientist hired a technician to do the grunt work of catching and releasing this particular pendulum, which was called a conical pendulum. You can Google what a conical pendulum looks like. Anyway, so they're doing this experiment, and Allais comes back, and the technician says, "Boss, you wouldn't believe, the damn thing went backwards," not knowing that overhead at the simultaneous observation of a bizarre mechanical backward rotation
of a pendulum on the rotating Earth, the technician saw this amazing effect.
What did he see?
The pendulum rotated backward.
Right.
Without any exterior forces or wind currents or whatever. And normally when you have something rotating in one direction, it doesn't stop and reverse. Kind of anti-Newton. So,
see, that would be an opposite spin.
Yeah, so it was only later that day that Maurice Allais, who went on to win the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1988, but whose first love was physics, discovered that afternoon in the skies of Paris above his laboratory, which was in a basement, no windows, there had been a partial solar eclipse, which had affected the pendulum.
Which is what just happened.
Yep.
Wow. Is what just happened. We're going to get into that tomorrow night, right?
You got it, because I think there are what I'll call time variable phenomenon in the solar system which come and go, and because they're not constant, they have been dismissed by both professionals and amateurs for literally hundreds of years as observer fatigue, equipment failure, plate breakdown. In other words, any excuse you can imagine, because we're supposed to live in a natural solar system, right?
Where everything is repeatable and reliable. So,
but if, in fact, it's not natural and modified and scrunched into a different form, and there is a technology still at some level operating, there are times when the phasing of our solar system and your invisible higher solar system could phase together, and then the invisible might become visible.
Exactly. And so that's why in the two periods of the miracle of the sun at Fatima, October 13th, 1917, and then again in late October 1950, are 33 years apart, which matches the Star of Bethlehem and the darkening of the sky, or the eclipse that occurred, crucifixion, which we know was not due to the sun and the moon. So,
okay, let me stop you there. Let me stop you there, because I want to interject a radical different thought and see how it bounces off you. When the U.S. government, when the CIA was creating a network of super spy satellites to fly over the Soviet Union and report back missiles and all that, and they had to do it with film, they couldn't do it electronically, because electronically our technology was not at that level yet. The military, as you know, code names everything, right? And in this sense, they codenamed this super spy satellite program that nobody was ever supposed to know existed. They called it Project Corona,
mm-hmm.
like the corona of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was leaked a whole reel of Project Corona film some years ago, what struck me is that every damn frame was of the moon and not of missile bases in the Soviet Union. So for some reason, the U.S. government, when it launched its first spy satellite into orbit around the Earth, above the atmosphere, in a vacuum, where they could look at wavelengths not accessible to telescopes and cameras on the ground, chose to shoot a reel of ultraviolet film of the moon, on which the lunar dome shows up again and again and again in a project codenamed Corona.
Wow, and ultraviolet, of course, is not visible, so therefore invisible, just like the apparition UFOs. They look like disks of structure, circular, but they were argued to be airy disks, which they were not because the camera was in focus, and they move around and they behave almost like living things, and they're extremely large. And they showed up on cameras that could see. You have ultraviolet near, ultraviolet far, and ultraviolet extreme. So you have three categories of UV. So again, if something is detectable in the invisible, it's real. It's
well, of
real.
It is.
We just can't see it
without proper instrumentation. I mean, that's what science has done. It's expanded our vision to encompass all kinds of things up to and including, you know, interdimensionality, hyperdimensionality. So the idea that you'd have phenomenon, if there are different levels of reality that are phased so they're only visible at certain times or angles, etc., wait till you see the data for tomorrow night. Wait.
I can't wait to see it. I'm definitely looking forward to this because this whole idea of proving, in fact, the great physicist John Nash, I actually read his biography, you know, that the movie Beautiful Mind was based on. In the book, he actually, his greatest equations were to mathematically prove the invisible was there. That was actually tangibly there. That's where he did his greatest work. He wasn't really going crazy. He was able to prove it mathematically. And those equations would have been thrown away or kept in some classified research facility.
Well, hold it there. We're at the top of the bottom. Bottom of the hour, yes. Get that right. My guest this morning, David Sarita, one last half hour to go. If you want to reach us on the phone, area code 917-889-8802. 917-889-8802. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone. Last half hour on The Other Side of Midnight for this Sunday night, Saturday night, Sunday morning here in the Land of Enchantment. My guest this morning is David Sarita. If you want to call us, 917-889-8802. 917-889-8802. Now, see, this is where things get really weird, David, because if all the mathematical evidence is aligned with the textual and religious and church institutional evidence. It means that the church, and by metonymy, the figures in the church, the leading lights of the dogma, of the ritual, of the reality, Mary, Jesus, etc., are part of this coded message, which has lasted for, pun intended, God knows how long.
Exactly. I mean, it's, imagine the way that the visible connects to the invisible. I'll give you an example here. I'm just going to read a paragraph of Mass, so I hope I don't hurt anybody. So Jesus requires the apostles to pick up and use their 2.5 royal cubit staff, which transmits at a wavelength 4 times its height, which equals 10 royal cubits. So, you know, 206 inches would be a 20.6 inch royal cubit, and that is the most perfect cubit we know of. And so therefore, you take that measurement of a wavelength of 10 royal cubits coming off the staff times the square root of pi, which is 1.77245, which would equal 365.258, which is a sidereal year on Earth accurate to 99.99%. Remember, there is no 100% time. And I multiply that by the golden ratio, and I get 591. So nobody can see 591. I experienced 591 in reverse, but this is proof that there's a reason that the staff had to be 2.5 long cubits, or a biblical cubit and a royal cubit are almost exactly the same thing. I mean, there's just a horse hair different from each other, all these different cubits. But the point is, it's perfectly proportional to this mythic 591, 19.5 in reverse number. So that means you're connecting visible to invisible. And when Robin sits on the bed in harmony to almost
Wait. You know, it wasn't Robin. It was a physical presence that sat on the bed. It was not her.
It wasn't her.
It was like a representation. I mean, this is going to sound really weird, David, but it was almost like an AI. And the communication of her loving me and then leaving through this doorway, this December 22nd doorway, which I identified with the alignment with the black hole in the center of the galaxy, was done in a way that was almost mechanical. It's like it wasn't Robin's personality at all, like several previous dreams between her death and this December 22nd night. But it was almost like an AI, artificial intelligence, communicating for her, like a representative, how much she loved me. But there was no her there. It was
right.
It was a presence, a physical presence that was invisible, except I got a kind of an impression that off to the right of the bed there was a tunnel. And maybe I was projecting, because I immediately realized it was the 22nd, because I'd gone to bed thinking, it's the solstice. If something's going to happen, it has to happen tonight. And it did. And then I rejected it the first time. And then it repeated. It's kind of like, remember that scene in,
Haunted Mansion?
No, it's Darth Vader and the princess and, you know,
right.
and Obi-Wan Kenobi triggers the hologram. And Leia, in a little miniature hologram, says, you know, your only hope.
Right.
It was that kind of staged AI holographic reality with the addition of the bed went down twice. That's a neat trick.
It's like my mom showing up on the morning of January 6th. It's all timed. It's like it's so... In fact, I had the most powerful spiritual experience of my life on December 22nd and 23rd, 1986. I It was like a near-death experience, and I was taken through the seven levels of heaven 2 days in a row, the most mind-blowing thing that's ever happened to me since I've been alive. But why that date again? The same, you know, the same point in the year with the winter solstice, right? The 22nd and the 23rd. I don't even know if it's a, if, is it the natural harmony of, the, imagine two and three musical notes being blended together to produce a movement in music. In music, the ratio of 1 to 1.618 to 1.1618, which is one, which is the golden ratio squared, is 2.618. Some of the planets are 1 to 1.618 apart, and some of them are 1 to 2.618, which is the golden ratio squared. That is a the proportion of a musical sixth, called a sixth in the music scales. So therefore, could it be a harmony that these experiences are coming in and going out on? And when these interactions with the invisible universe come and interact with the visible universe and surprise us, because these intervals are extremely rare. So you think about the interval between Jesus's birth date, which would have been in August, and the Bethlehem, the star of Bethlehem, and then he dies 33 years later, and then you have the eclipse of a interdimensional planet on the crucifixion, which means the moment of his crucifixion had to happen on that date. It had to, if it was a planetary phenomenon. But,
and we now know, because of the backdating of one of my, you know, colleagues, that August dates, regardless of where the moon or the sun is, that's 19.47 degrees from spring, the first point of Aries. And that angle in the physics of a resonating four-dimensional set of solar systems, with two of them in the current set we're thinking of, interacting easier at that point than maybe any other time in the year.
Right. So that's the point. Like, again, when I studied all these Marian apparitions, on the ones that I could get the exact dates on, when she started appearing and then when she stopped appearing, they were in harmony.
But see, that's the thing I asked a few moments ago. How can a natural background physics reality be modulated by the appearance of supernatural or spiritual beings in a cultural mythos devoted to one on one planet with billions of people? In other words, this is tracking a phenomenology that appears to be an imprint from a higher source to have us look to our rituals, because there is where the secret of the real supernatural is buried in plain sight.
Exactly. Like when I showed the lunar calendar for Yom Kippur juxtaposed to the solar calendar, it lines up to planet 139. And we don't know what we're doing in that ritual on that date. We don't know it lines up to a periodal orbit of an invisible. Again, I don't know if it's a planet. It might be a portal. That imagine a portal circulating in an orbit around the sun.
Well, wait. If you're proposing that the appearance of the Fatima apparition, the so-called, you know, solar eclipse,
the miracle of the sun,
If that was, as you're describing it, an annular eclipse, meaning
not
you had a body, you had the sun or the image of the sun. Then you had a ring and then a dark center. That could be created by all kinds of other things other than a real planet. It could be a spacecraft. Could be a habitat.
Well, I looked at the spacecraft idea. Yeah, you have to understand. So when a spacecraft is going to produce a good shadow on the ground, you would have full visibility of the structure of that craft. And if it was
not necessarily. That's part of the data I'm going to show you tomorrow night.
What if, like the Dark Star, the Death Star in Star Wars, what if either there is a planet that has technology to cloak itself?
You're getting warm.
But it's like this whole idea of what do we call it, a Dyson sphere? You know, the
Dyson sphere. Warmer.
What if what if there are planets that are inhabited by super humans, gods, goddesses, that have a technology to make their whole planet invisible and fly their craft to and fro? I mean, that's one hypothesis, but it has a period. Remember, Fatima 2...
So, but if it has a theory, that indicates it's a natural triggered phenomenon. The physics reconstructs itself now, then, and it's periodic.
Yeah, so imagine if Jesus' birth date and his death date are 33 years apart, and there's a solar planetary phenomenon on those two dates, and then in the year 1917 and 1950, it happens again 33 years apart. That shows repetition of period, just like a Venus transit. But Venus transit, strangely, their second time around, the pair won't be the same distance apart. That's interesting, because they're different in the number of days apart between the pair of Venus transits. And yet, in this case, they're the same number of days apart. So maybe it's not a planet. Maybe it's something like you're saying. I don't know what it is, because when something's invisible, you don't know what it is until you got your hands on it, until you've been asked. But it does follow that mathematical period, and that is phenomenal, that you can use math. And remember, John Nash, you know, the movie Beautiful Mind was made about him in the book.
Yeah, but you still haven't answered the question I asked earlier, which is, why do these cultural appearances match the physics? Why is Mary appearing in resonance with this invisible physics? Why is a people, a person, a personality, a construct, the mother of God in that whole Roman Catholic motif, why is that persona following a hyper-dimensional model?
Well, okay, go to my item 6, people, because this is part of my answer. Is item 6 is Peter Lamazurier's book, The Great Pyramid Decoded. This is page 227, shows the base of the Great Pyramid measured precisely, and A to B, which is the straight edge of the side base of the Great Pyramid, because the Great Pyramid has this, in three dimensionality, it has a dip, which is A to E to F to B. But A to B in sacred cubits, and a sacred cubit is 25 inches, is 365.242 days, which is the number of days in a mean solar tropical year, which relies on the equinoxes for its measurement. And A to E to F to B is 365.256, which is a sidereal year. And A to little b to b is 365.259 sacred cubits, the number of days at an anomalistic year, Earth's orbital revolution. So why would the pyramid, at this precise measurement, and these are in primitive inches, which is 1.00106 standard inches. I mean, it's a really simple conversion. Why does it record three of the ways we measure a year precisely?
Because it was a library of constants in stone.
It's pointing to the orbital period, and yet it's ascending, descending, ascending passage at 26.3 degrees is the slope angle of a missing planet to complete the 360-degree circle, which is where I started tonight. So that would mean that the pyramid has a function that we haven't even figured out yet. It has a function. Now, did you know, this was in Robert Temple's book on the mystery of the Sphinx, that the ancient Egyptians would lay on these wedges, they would lay their bodies in ritualistic angles, induce an experience. So we know they worked with staffs, because we see the staff evident everywhere in the ancient Egyptian world. Also, we know that Moses and Aaron and the 12 tribes of Israel had their staffs. But laying at angles that are very specific would at very specific directions, in the cardinal directions, would invoke an experience. This is very well documented in Robert Temple's work. So angle, if you lay your body at the angle of one of the different planets in the solar system, would you have an experience with that planet? I mean, that's a hypothetical
question. Let me raise you with an anecdote, a story, which is pretty remarkable. And we're at 47 minutes after the hour, so we don't have much time till the end. What if the pyramid was basically a transdimensional beaming device?
Oh yeah, I believe it was.
And the coffer, which of course looks like a coffin, is not a coffin. It was something that you lay down in to be beamed somewhere.
Well, that's supposedly what happens to Napoleon when he goes in and he lays in the coffer.
He has this incredible experience he will not describe, and no one could ever get him to talk about it. It was shattering for him. Well, I had a very good friend, Boris Said, who had a similar experience. He was doing a documentary with a friend of mine, Bill Cody, from New York, and he had a young assistant, and they had bribed, you know, the guards so they could stay overnight in the pyramid, and the idea was to carry out certain measurements having to do with sound, I think. And Boris was the camera guy, he was the principal. Bill was the camera guy, and the assistant was just taking notes. And they're in there in the middle of the night, and Boris falls, they all fall asleep. And Boris decided that if he was going to be overwhelmingly tired, he would crawl into the casket, the coffer, and lie down there because it was elevated. It was protected from the floor. He just wanted to do that. And he had the most bizarre dream where he woke up, left the king's chamber, went down to a little inn in the pyramid village by the Sphinx there, where some of his friends, because he had a lot of Arab friends. And he, you know, plays a game of, I forget what the board game was, and he wins, and he carves his initials in the table, and then he wakes up in the pyramid, and he realizes it was a dream, except when he'd gone outside in the dream, it had rained. And when he and Bill and the assistant exited the pyramid, it had rained overnight and there were puddles. And he went down to the pub, because by now he was really intrigued. And he goes in and he goes to the table where he had been sitting playing this board game. And there are his initials.
Oh, my God. See, that suggests that it's an interdimensional.
Yes, it's a portal back and forth, and Robin and Crystal have figured out a partial way to communicate through this barrier.
See, you notice that the king's chamber is 10 by 20 royal cubits, or long cubits, or the Hebrew long cubit. And see, at the time of Moses, you had the Holy of Holies was a tent. So it's 10 by 10 of those long or royal cubits. And that's the measurement of the Queen's Chamber. And that's where the Ark of the Covenant and the staffs were kept. Now, at the time of Moses, extending beyond the Holy of Holies was called the Holy Place, which is 10 by 20 of those cubits, which is the King's Chamber. So why do we have the same measurements? But at the time of Solomon, all of those measurements double. So the Holy of Holies becomes 20 by 20, and the Holy Place becomes 20 by 40 of those long cubits. So the Y, which is really, in frequency terms, is an octave shift.
Yes, exactly.
Because
yeah.
It's 1 to 2. It's a 1 to 2.
Yep.
So the point is, why are the pyramid measurements the same as Moses' measurements? Because they're the same. And yet, there's supposedly different gods going on here. So there's something we don't really understand.
Oh, there's a common source. we're missing.
No, there's something we completely don't understand because Peter Levinson.
Wait. Actually, we do. If you have two sets of numbers from different cultures and the same numbers, I would say that the numbers apply to the physics of the situation.
Right.
Resonance,
yeah.
Music,
yeah,
tones, you know, octaves, all that. Individually preserved in separate cultures in separate ways, but they ultimately mean the same thing.
And guess what Le Mesurier discovers? He discovers that the word for their ancient tonal language for their god was Hufwa, which became Kufa, which was Yawa, which apparently meant the same thing, the supreme I am. And then it became Kufu instead of Kufa, which was formerly Hufwa, which was the same as Yawa. It was all the same.
But that indicates that Khufu was not in the fourth dynasty, that he was a reflection of an incredibly more ancient history with the name of God attached.
That's exactly right. And do you know that, this really gets amazing.
We have not talked about this before, right, David?
The word for the sun god was Tawa. Yawa, Tawa, Hufwa, Kufa. You see how in different languages and cultures it transliterates. It's philology. It's the history of word, which if you listen to the sound of our sun, it's going, whoa, 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 whoa. You see? So I think we might be more unified.
It's like that opening in Star Trek IV.
I love that one. You know, I was on the set of Star Trek IV, and I got to meet everybody on the set. You're talking about
with the whales, right?
Yes, yes, that musical, whoa, 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 whoa. It's a transposition. Remember, these films are also parables at some level. Whether conscious
or tuned into the sound of the sun, and the sound of the sun is the Tawa, the Yawa, the Hufwa.
And the hyperdimensional frequency of the planet.
Kufa becomes Khufu, which becomes a person instead of what it really was.
Exactly.
The ancient, the most, this is all in Peter Le Mesurier's book, by the way. This isn't my theory. He really documents this. He does an incredible job of math and the history of the transliteration of word, which is logos, which is vibration. So a vibration became a word, and then when we spell the word differently, we all start going to war with each other, thinking that we're all have different religions when really our source has unification, and we don't see that, right? And that's why those measurements of the king and queen's chamber really interest me, comparing them to Moses's Holy of Holies and Tabernacle when it was the tent where they carried the Ark of the Covenant, because why would his God give him the same measurements that are in the pyramid unless there was a connection? There had to be.
What I want to know is when Boris lay down in the coffer and went to sleep and woke up and went out to the pub and carved his initials and then woke up for real and went out and went to the pub and there they are. Where did he go? How did that happen?
I know. See, this, it gets tricky. So when you think of what the pyramid's made out of, the core masonry is right.
Oh, it's a hyperdimensional machine, and the way you activate it is you resonate it with sound. Stan Tenen, my departed Jewish scholar friend, you know, went into the physics of the Great Pyramid long before we'd figured out any of this stuff. And he said the secret is resonant frequencies produced in that long, you know, series of chambers funneling through the portcullis into the king's chamber. And if you input the right frequencies, did you beam somebody in the coffer somewhere else?
I know the frequency. I've calculated them, and that'd be another show, because I actually have those numbers.
Well, our friend Michael Hill's 432 is all over the Giza Plateau and the Great Pyramid.
Oh, yeah. It's all over the place there, yeah. Do you know that?
Well, it's also all over the solar system.
The breastplate of Aaron, and I've measured it precisely. It took me a long time going through the ancient Talmud to get the real measurements. The wavelength of the square is 432 megahertz square wave. It's 432 freaking megahertz. And remember, the Ginny Blanchett's radios were tuned to 432 megahertz when we were sending messages to Oumuamua at 432 megahertz. And then we were listening back at 432 megahertz. And we also worked with 144 megahertz.
By the way, can you find out from Jimmy if he ever got those echoed recordings I asked for? Because when he beamed something with that 150 kilowatt signal at the moon, that is so much more powerful than the original Project Diana moon bounce U.S. Army Signal Corps of Engineers.
Oh, get those numbers.
Back in 1946. So we just need to see if he's got echoes on his recordings. That's all.
Right. Yeah. That would be. It's
from what you are going to see tomorrow night, that is a very important piece of data we need to find out from Jimmy.
Okay. Send me an email.
I will send you an email. Yes, I will send you an email. You realize that we're almost out of time?
I know.
We've got about 30 seconds left. So say something pithy.
Well, you know, I know that we probably went over some heads tonight, but I think that
they can always listen to the replay and replay it again and again and look at the graphs, look at the numbers.
We need an astronomer who's willing to look at this data. We need an Avi Loeb who can look at this data. Remember, we were talking about trying to get to him.
I'm working on it. Hey, David, I want to thank
you.
Okay, see you tonight. David Sarita, everybody, give him a big hand because he deserves it. You know, all that mathematics. But if you leave this show tonight with only one gestalt, which is we live not at random, but in someone's design. So until tomorrow night, remember, third star on the left, right on till morning. Good night, everyone. See you tomorrow night.